It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, we first speak with naturalist and writer Jeremy Minot. Minot is an emeritus fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and was formerly chief executive of Cambridge University Press. Mm. His latest book is titled The Story of Nature, A Human History.
That's right. Nature has long been the source of human curiosity, wonder, and inspiration for some of our deepest creative impulses. But all this is now under challenge as we witness its accelerating impoverishment, consumption, and deconstruction. The story of nature traces humans' evolving relationships with our natural world, from cave paintings to Aristotle, St. Francis, Darwin, Thoreau, and Carson. And Minot reveals now how our impulse to control and domesticate nature has deep roots, and yet how our imagination and wonder can play a curative and restorative role. Jeremy Minot and his book, The Story of Nature, in the first half of the show.
And then we're going to be having local parkite and longtime arborist Keith Clapier, who is going to be coming into the studio to discuss what factors to consider when choosing a tree species to plant in and around Park City, which species will ensure sustainability, which make the biggest environmental impact, and what's happening with disease and the beetles and all of that is coming our way this summer.
If not already here in some part.
We've been experiencing this in Summit County, so he'll have information on all of that.
Perfect. Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
This morning, as we just said, we're going to first be speaking with naturalist and writer Jeremy Minot, who has just penned a new book called The Story of Nature, A Human History. Jeremy, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. You find me in the middle of a heat wave in Suffolk, England at the moment.
Oh, my goodness.
A record heat wave, right, Jeremy?
Well, indeed. Yesterday, the last day of June, broke records in various parts of Europe for heat. And so it's relevant to the theme of your program.
Exactly. We do talk a lot about what is happening with our climate and the warming world. Absolutely. Well, Jeremy, we are so glad to have you this morning on This Green Earth. And before we dive into the history of our relationship with nature and really discover the passages in your book, let's learn first a little history about you. Share with us when and why you first became a naturalist. Why was it this path in your life? What spoke to you about it?
Well, it was at a very early age, really. I was lucky enough to be born into a family that encouraged me to take an interest and allowed me to roam fairly wild in a way that I think is quite difficult for children nowadays for all sorts of reasons. From an early age, I was encouraged just to explore the natural world. And a very important part in all this was a book that they gave me, I think, for my fifth birthday. It was a bird book. And I still have it. It's in a desperate state at the moment. But it was a book that introduced me to birds. And I made my mother read it to me as my bedtime story every night. And I carried it with me everywhere, indoors and out. And that really got me going. And as I say, the freedom I was given, fortunately, by my circumstances to just to wander was a great benefit to me in finding nature for myself, which I think is terribly important, finding personal encounters.
Right. Yeah, and you certainly utilize that knowledge you gained from that book. You yourself have penned a book about birds recently, yes?
Yes, indeed. My first books were about birds. My background actually was in publishing. I spent most of my publishing career at Cambridge University Press, and it was when I retired, though I don't like to use that word, I became differently employed, and I started writing about nature, that I began writing about birds. And then more recently, as you've explained in my most recent book, about nature as a whole and the way that we've tried to respond to it over the ages.
Well, the book, The Story of Nature, takes on kind of the arc of humans' relationships with nature from the books, religious texts, and other more pure scientific texts, and all the way back to the first chapter, titled "When We Were Nature: The World of the Cave Painters." Talk about why you start with cave painters and cave paintings and their importance with us understanding our role with relationship with nature.
Yes, well, I started there because that's really our first evidence, in this case, visual evidence, of the way that people were relating to the natural world around them. And as we know from these extraordinary cave paintings and from smaller sculptures which they produced, they had an intimate relationship with, an intimate knowledge of the natural world. Indeed, there was not the same distance between humans and the natural world then as there is now. We were a part of nature. We were one animal amongst others. And that's what gives that period its fascination, I think. It was only in later ages that we started separating ourselves from nature.
Yeah, and you talk about that separation. What does that evolution look like in that separation, that first evolution?
I think the first big separation came with what we call the agricultural revolution, when human beings first started domesticating the natural world and taming animals and growing crops. That's when we made a separation between humans and animals, or humans and wildlife.
And then in chapter 3, titled The Invention of Nature, you start with the sentence, the Greeks invented the idea of nature, and they had a word for it. What was that word, and why do you suggest that the Greeks, you know, quote-unquote, invented nature? They were the idea of it.
The word they had was physis, from which we get words like physiology and physics and so on. And the Latin equivalent of that a bit later was natura, from which, of course, we get nature and its cognates. When I say they invented nature, I was being a bit provocative. Nature always existed, of course, but it was the first time that people had conceptualized it, had understood it sufficiently to be able to make a concept of the word nature and start thinking in an articulate way about our relationship with nature. And indeed, many of the Greeks, most famously Aristotle, but some pre-Socratic philosophers before him, speculated in the most interesting ways about nature. And Aristotle, of course, wrote the very first major zoology, setting out what was then known about the natural world and its taxonomies.
Yeah, I actually highlighted that. Aristotle did many things and wrote about many different areas of philosophy, but he wrote a book titled, or volumes about, History of Animals. 10 volumes, I'd say.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of questioned. Would you consider him one of the first Western zoologists?
Very definitely, yes. He was the first major Western zoologist. And of course, he had a huge influence right through the Middle Ages into the Renaissance. And indeed, some of his theories weren't challenged, although they should have been, until the Renaissance itself. He called that book The History of Nature, and that's an English translation, which is slightly misleading in that the Greek word historia just means an inquiry. It's not a history. He wasn't writing a history in a chronological sense. He was writing a research into nature.
And was he actually studying nature, or was he just kind of collecting, you know, anecdotes or observations around him, etc.?
He did both. He got his hands dirty. He was an active naturalist. He did a lot of field work, particularly on marine animals on a Greek island called Lesvos, which you probably know,
right,
and made many personal inventions. But he also collected data and information from a whole range of informants to make his history of nature as comprehensive as possible. It's an extraordinary work. I mean, it's extraordinarily detailed and with a tremendous number of observations. And one of the most striking things for me is it's not just a list of species, as it might be, but it's an explanation of how, in his opinion, these species react to their surroundings and how they're equipped to deal with their surroundings. He didn't use the word evolution or adaptation in quite the sense in which Darwin did, but a lot of what he provides is actually about adaptation and evolution.
Right, that's what I was going to ask, if scientists from that point on looked at Aristotle and maybe were influenced by Aristotle's work.
They certainly did. Several of the Renaissance zoologists and encyclopedists specifically modeled their work on Aristotle. I've got a picture somewhere in the book of Conrad Gesner, who immodestly describes himself as the second Aristotle, and says this picture, I can't quite remember the exact word, he said, this picture isn't of you, Aristotle, it's of me, but we both have the same genius.
Well put. Now,
and he then, said it in Latin.
Okay. Moving on to another chapter titled The Books of God and of Nature. Yeah. So religion's kind of role or take on nature. St. Francis, among many. St. Francis played an important role in, I guess, trying to describe or explain nature with respect to, you know, God's work and our reasons to protect and be mindful of nature as a way of thanking God.
Yes, St. Francis comes across as a very modern figure, I think, in that respect. As the stories go, he had an extraordinarily close relationship with animals of all kinds. Indeed, there are stories of him preaching to the birds, if you remember, mm-hmm. and he regards all animals as his brothers. But it has to be said that he was untypical of his time and untypical of that religious tradition as a whole. The Old Testament, as you know, in Genesis, makes a very sharp distinction between humans and the natural world, and it proclaims the right of human beings to dominate the natural world. There are some very powerful verses in Genesis that say that very explicitly. St. Francis, as I say, was a very modern figure and would be hailed as a hero by the modern animal rights movement, I'm sure.
Yes.
We talk about our relationship with nature on the show all the time. We have talked with many people about how we rely on nature.
It's in our tagline, Claire,
it is,
right?
Yes.
Our relationships with nature.
Yes, and the power of nature and how we really have romanticized it. We mimic it in what we do on our day-to-day lives, in machinery, in our fabrics, in how we dress. But we also somehow have this feeling that we are somehow in control of it. So I'm curious of your thoughts of when did we start to really think that this was ours to control instead of be a part of and live amongst and move forward with?
Well, I'm afraid for the most of human history, we've thought that it was ours to control. And it was actually an American environmentalist, George Perkins Marsh, who was writing in the middle of the 19th century, who drew attention to the environmental threat that mankind poses. He says something like, man is everywhere the destroyer. And I think he's a very important figure in environmental history, because it was from him that other figures like Aldo Leopold and John Muir and so on took their inspiration. And that leads directly to people like Rachel Carson in the 20th century. So I think the American tradition is extremely important here.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Jeremy Minot. Jeremy is an emeritus fellow of Wolfson College in Cambridge and was formerly chief executive of Cambridge University Press. And we're talking to him about his latest book titled The Story of Nature, A Human History. That's interesting, Jeremy. I'd never heard of George Perkins Marsh. You know, you hear about other icons of Thoreau and so forth, but not Marsh.
Well, I would look him up. I think the book was published in 1864, and it's called something like Man and Nature. I think that may be its title. You wouldn't call it that nowadays, of course, but that was the title then. And it's the first serious environmental analysis of the world's geography and the way that humans impact upon it. And yes, he was a really important figure, and I think he ought to be better known.
Well, one person I'm so glad you mentioned is the gentleman E.F. Schumacher, who's actually, I believe, an economist by trade. But
yes,
he wrote an amazing book, which my dad gave me when I was in high school. It was quite a dense volume. It is titled The Small is Beautiful, A Study of Economics as If People Mattered. Can you take, if you're aware of that book, could you take a few minutes to talk about the importance of that book?
I think it was, I mean, I'm not an economist, but I think it was important that it challenged some of the basic assumptions of economic theory. and challenged the idea that everything was reducible to economic factors. And I think this is an extremely important theme for modern conservation movements. They're sometimes driven by political pressures to justify conservation purely in economic terms, you know, how much the environment is worth to us in monetary terms. There's a second tradition, which Schumacher was important in stimulating and helping to inspire, that nature is intrinsically important to us. And that's a different way of thinking about it. And so I think Schumacher played quite an important role there. He enabled us to think outside standard economic theory, and he had the authority of being an economist himself.
Right, yeah. It was a totally different take on the other books I was reading at the time, of course, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and other books about population and et cetera. And so to bring the economics into it was something kind of invited those that weren't necessarily environmentalists to take a look and consider the importance and the benefacts of nature in our economy. So
yeah,
great that you mentioned that. Another book I recommend for people to read. So moving into the, like I say, now into the 20th century, we really start to ramp up our consumption of nature, like you say, our natural resources of earth and of wood and of animals and water, and generating more and more waste from that, and of course fossil fuels. When did you see perhaps a turn, maybe Schumacher part of that, a turn to suggest that, hold on here, we are on a slippery slope to not only consuming most of our natural resources, but generating so much waste that the consequences to our public health is dire. Was there an arc there, a change, a tipping point?
I think you could say that Rachel Carson herself was the tipping point in 1962. She drew attention, as you know, to the effects of pesticides on wildlife. And to begin with, she was first disbelieved, and then, of course, the agricultural industries defended themselves vigorously against her. But she won out, and her voice was heard in the end. And indeed, her book reached the desk of John F. Kennedy, who took some action about it. And I think that was a crucial stage. Since then, we haven't solved the problems. We've made them worse in some ways. Mm. And there are, of course, powerful environmental movements in nearly every country now, drawing attention to the damage that we're doing. And it's a real problem, because we all know what the problem is now, and we know what some of the solutions are, at least some of the solutions. But it's very difficult for governments to seize this, and difficult for individuals to seize it, because seizing it means accepting some diminution in our standards of living and our freedoms of behavior in future. But if we don't accept those limitations, then this thing is coming at us like a train.
It's so much to absorb, and the book is very dense. When you're writing this and you're going through this process, even you emotionally and talking about these things and working through the history of it, and then getting to maybe what we're looking towards in our future, what we're facing in our future, what was that evolution inside of you, and what were some of the things along the way that hit you the most?
Well, that's a deep question. When I was writing the later chapters of the book on modern conservation movements, and my chapter called Future Nature, on the way it's all going and the threats we might face in the future, I was feeling quite pessimistic, I must say, and I thought, well, I can't just end up like this. Mm. And so right towards the end, I try and appeal to our imaginative resources, and I have quite a bit to say about the faculty of human wonder. I think wonder is a wonderful human resource. It combines scientific, aesthetic, artistic responses to nature, both wondering about nature in a sense of curiosity and wondering at nature in a sense of admiring it and being in awe of it. And I think we have to appeal to factors like wonder to inspire us. And there are ways of inspiring people.
Yeah, I love that you bend in that direction, because we have, from the get-go, had these romantic or creative relationships with nature and throughout poetry and art and how we communicate with each other. We use a lot of examples in nature to do so. And I love how you bring it back to innately our relationship with and our desire to protect and be a part of nature.
Well, thank you. I do feel that very strongly. And as you may have read, I end the book with a very specific case of a bird that the turtle dove, which was a key part of the soundtrack of summer for me once, but has, I'm afraid, diminished in its numbers very greatly in the last few years. We've lost 98% of our turtle doves in Britain, despite its great importance in our cultural history. But the good news is I found one yesterday.
Wow.
And I'm again thrilled to hear that lovely purring note from a turtle dove, which is the sound of summer for me.
Well, that's encouraging. I mean, are there efforts in Great Britain to try to recover its population?
There are efforts, but it's hard to deal with it, because the causes are, some of them, away from this country. Some of the causes are in its wintering grounds. It's a summer migrant in Britain. It winters in Africa. And some of its wintering grounds are being subjected to clearances and developments. The problem in Britain has been that it's the victim, as so many things are, of intensive agriculture, where agriculture has rooted up hedges, drenched the countryside with pesticides, and destroyed some of the seeds and insects that are the natural food of farmland birds like the turtle dove, and also other birds like the corn bunting and so on and so forth. There's a long litany of names I could pull out, but it's the same in America. Agricultural intensity has done huge damage, and so, of course, has urban development.
Yeah, and many times it's up to, say, the backyard birder, individuals like yourself or those who love birds or other animals in general to kind of turn their backyards into nurseries and sanctuaries.
Absolutely. Yes, we must do that, yes.
Last minute or so, yes, the epilogue is titled Loss, Wonder, and Meaning. You know, one thing you didn't mention was the fact that, not among all those other things, you mentioned that the turtle dove are suffering is a warmer world, too, added upon that as kind of a force multiplier to make things even more difficult for a lot of our ecosystem. Our show deals with these things every week. We try to have a sense of wonder and a sense of hope. Do you see pockets of hope and activities from individuals or governments, societies, organizations, in trying to make change?
Definitely pockets of hope. There are lots and lots of individuals or wildlife enthusiasts. There are lots of important conservation bodies, both national and international. But it's a really severe political problem. It was rather nicely summarized by a French politician, Jean-Claude Juncker, who said in a rather different context, "We know what we have to do, but we just don't know how to get elected once we've done it." And that's a real political problem.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. The name of the book is The Story of Nature, A Human History. The author is Jeremy Minot. Jeremy, is there a website that people can go to learn more about this book and about your other works?
Yes, I have a personal website. If you just put in my name, Jeremy Minot, you'll get to it.
That's M-Y-N-O-T-T.
O-double-T.
O-double-T.
And you can also see a selection of my monthly nature notes, taking a delight in my surroundings around here.
Oh, nice.
I love that. And I love that you are personifying what you just said about experiencing the awe in nature, and that you are experiencing this wonder and sharing with us all of that. So yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yes, thanks, Jeremy.
Well, thank you so much for taking such sympathetic interest in my book. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Well, absolutely. This is naturalist and author Jeremy Minot, who has penned the book, The Story of Nature, A Human History. It's a beautiful book. There are illustrations
in it.
Great
guy illustrations.
It is a phenomenal read, and we encourage everyone out there to take a look. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for being a part of this Green Earth.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm most grateful.
Joining us for the second part of the show is Keith Claypere. He is an arborist, a certified arborist, and he's here to talk about trees, of course, and trees here in around Park City and Summit County. Keith, thanks so much for joining us this morning on the show.
My pleasure.
How long have you been working as an arborist in Park City, Summit County?
So I started my business just before I was the arborist for Red Barn. Sorry, I didn't mean to do a plug. That would have been the year 2000. But prior to that, I got approximately 20 years with the U.S. Forest Service.
Really? Working out west here?
In six western states.
Wow.
Mostly here in Utah, though, like Wasatch Cache.
Yeah, okay.
So I've been working with trees all my life. I got a degree in forestry up at Utah State in the late 70s, and then I wanted to be a wildlife biologist, so I went into zoology, got a degree in zoology, but now I'm back working with trees.
Okay.
And what was it about trees that drew you? Was it when you were a kid? Did you have an affinity for the forest? Did you have an affinity for being out amongst the trees? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I love trees. I mean, and the more you study them, the more you appreciate them. You know, we couldn't have life on Earth without them, obviously.
Right.
And, you know, my real passion is birds and wildlife. And, you know, trees are the eco, meaning house.
Right.
They're the structure of the ecosystem.
Right. They're like everything from nursery to home to security, all of that. And so, like you say, Keith, no trees, no us, in effect. What changes have you seen over the decades that you've been working as an arborist with respect to trees, tree health, tree types, et cetera?
So this is kind of up your alley. Obviously, global warming, you know, and in the last 100 years, temperatures have gone up 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. We stay on this trajectory. By the year 2100, the climate in Park City will be very much like the climate in Heber City right now. So that's going to affect the selection of trees, the pests, the diseases of trees, availability of water, you know, infrastructure.
So if it looks more like, if our ecosystem or the temperatures are more like Heber, what trees are most impacted as a
All
result?
Right. So we're going to move away from a spruce and aspen landscape and more to a more drought-tolerant urban tree type, urban forest. Right now, you don't want to plant aspen on the south face of your house surrounded by hardscape. You're just asking for trouble. Primarily, they get a fungal infection. They get a borer, and frankly, they don't live very long in the landscape. So there are better choices to use as the climate warms up.
Okay. Describe what a borer is and why it's infesting so many of our trees.
All right, so there's three order of insects that bore into trees. The primary one's the coleopteran, and those are the beetles. And there are different kind of borers. There's roundhead borers, flathead borers, bark beetles. Bark beetles are more closely related to weevils, but they're all very destructive because they mine into the phloem of the tree, which is where the tree transports its carbohydrates from the leaves down into the roots. That's what they're after. They're after the carbohydrates.
So when you're seeing this happening, is it because of the climate? Is it because of human encroachment? What is it that's bringing these on more?
Well, it's all of the above, but primarily what happens is the climate warms trees become stressed. Mm. And as they become stressed, it predisposes them to pests and diseases. It weakens them. They don't have the defense to fend them off. They're just trying to stay alive. And as a result, they get overpowered by, usually the numbers have to build up, and then they overwhelm the tree's defense system.
How does the tree, how does it express itself if it's infested with borers? What am I looking for?
Well, so it depends on the borer. Let's take an example of the saperted borer, the one that attacks aspen. Oftentimes, you'll see resin dripping out of the trunk of the tree in a crescent-shaped exit hole. You may see what's called excelsior, which is like a gummy sawdust around the exit hole, or it may be found near the base of the tree. And then you'll start to see flagging and declining canopy, because what results, it's the larvae that does the damage to the tree. And as they mine those carbohydrates, they girdle the tree, and that results in vascular dysfunction.
Wow, okay. So looking for, you said that we shouldn't be planting aspen in our yards. I think you suggested on the south side.
South-facing.
Is other facing sides for aspen?
So east-facing would be fine, provided it's not next to cement or asphalt, or even west-facing. But south-facing, especially this time of year, it's just too hot, southwest side of your house, and it's really easy to stress them. And the other thing is, people don't necessarily water them properly.
Ah.
So that, exacerbates the situation.
What should a typical watering schedule be like?
So spruce and aspen need an inch of water a week.
Wow.
Same as Kentucky bluegrass. They're not drought tolerant.
Spruce is not drought tolerant.
No.
So it's getting stressed. From my informal records, we haven't had rain, any measurable rain in over a month, maybe today. So those spruce are under stress.
Well, it depends on when the tree was planted. It depends on the age of the tree. Obviously, bigger spruce trees need more water. And that's another problem I see in Park City. People start watering their spruce, but they never alter their watering regimen. And as the trees get bigger, they're using more water, but they're given the same amount of water they did 5 or 10 years ago.
Wow.
So when you look at the landscape just behind us, I had a picture that I took from many moons ago, a couple decades ago when I first arrived here. And it seems like last year I took a photo also in that same spot looking back at the hill. And there was a lot more brown. There was a lot, it looked like a lot more stress. What is happening there?
Well, you're looking at aspen and primarily white fir. There could be some Douglas fir, but if you notice, a lot of the white fir have spike tops.
Mm-hmm.
That's caused by the fir engraver beetle, and it tends to attack the leader of the tree and work its way down the trunk. If the tree's healthy, it can live with it for decades. If they become stressed because of global warming or construction activity, then the beetle will progress further down the trunk.
And if I understand the fact that, say, for example, bark beetles are surviving more winters, where it used to be, decades ago, the winters were so cold that they would kill off the beetle. So we're seeing examples of that continuing in the national forest, but even around here?
Yeah, that definitely plays a role. The other thing is, as the forest matures, they reach a certain size, like 12 inches or more DBH. And if you have a whole entire forest of a certain age class, that's just recipe for bark beetles, because they like the larger trunk because there's more carbohydrate.
Oh, they do. So it's all about the carbohydrate.
Yeah, they don't attack the smaller diameter stems.
Oh.
They have to be about 12 inches or bigger.
And that's their preferred.
So decades of fire suppression was great, but now we're getting this maturing forest that's ripe for beetle infestation. We don't have a diversity of age classes. They're all the same age, a lot of forest.
Okay. And we don't have enough woodpeckers.
Well,
to manage.
We do.
We need more woodpeckers.
There's more beetles than woodpeckers.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
Just speaking as a birder, yeah, it'd be nice to see some more woodpeckers do it.
It's not just woodpeckers, you know. There's all kinds of birds, nuthatches.
They'll all feed on.
You know, creepers and things like that. It'll pick in the bark.
Okay. We're speaking with Keith Claypere. He's a Park City arborist, owner of the company Park City Arborist LLC. And we're talking about trees here in Park City. Let's get back to people's yards, landscaping. What are some trees that you, if somebody says like, oh, I love aspens, you know, I love their color in the fall, and I want a row of aspens here. What might you say to them to compel them to think of other trees?
Well, I love aspen too. I own a quarter acre of in situ native aspen. They're a keystone species. Our forest couldn't live without them. So get back to your answer. It depends on the site. Again, if it's a hot south-facing side of your yard, surrounded by hardscape, not a good site for aspen.
Mm.
They won't live very long. They'll die of canker or borers before they die of old age. And by the way, aspen stems, the stem itself, they only live about 100 years. The root, on the other hand, can live for tens of thousands of years.
The root?
Yeah.
So
they reproduce primarily vegetatively, asexually. They don't want to do that, but it's part of their strategy because they're a pioneer species. They're able to get in rapidly and reproduce before anything else.
And then they set up whole like colonies.
Correct.
Or
correct.
What's the term? I'm trying to think of the term.
A clone?
A clone, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the largest one is Pando. It's 106
Pando.
Acres.
Okay.
It shows you the how big they can grow.
106 acres of one continuous effect.
Correct.
Plant.
One individual.
100, incredible.
But we have numerous clones on our hillside, and the best time to identify them is in the spring and fall.
And how do we
So the easiest way to tell is by when they leaf out. Certain clones will leaf out sooner than others. And then in the fall, when the leaves turn yellow, certain clones turn yellow before other clones. So you can actually map them on the hillside.
Oh, no kidding. Anywhere like locally?
I've done it in my own yard. I live in Timberline, and the aspen in my yard is the same clone as my neighbor across the street. And I figured that out by when they leafed out in the spring and when they turn yellow in the fall.
Oh, amazing. And that's the only tree...
Well, you can do a DNA analysis as well.
Oh, okay. But that's the only tree that kind of acts like that?
Oak reproduced vegetatively, gamble oak.
Down below.
The interesting thing about clones is they're different sexes. So you could have a female clone, you could have a male clone.
Oh, okay.
And how do you decipher that?
Well, you can tell by the catkin. They both have catkins, but the female catkin on an aspen is longer than a male catkin.
Catkin.
I need to define that for us.
Catkin is the reproductive structure of members of the willow family, which is what aspen is. So if you go along the rivers, I think you're a fly fisherman.
Yep.
You see those big, long, spiky things on the willows. Those are all catkins.
Catkins.
So it helps taxonomists identify the species as well.
So how about willows and say cottonwoods or so? What is the state of their health? And is that something that we might want to consider for our yards?
So, yeah, I mean, as long as you protect the shoreline, you know, I don't think willows are any real harm, danger of disappearing. You know, they have their threats from grazing primarily.
Huh.
Everything likes to eat willow, cows, sheep, goats, deer, elk, moose. Same with aspen. They're very, very palatable.
They're leaves. They're
the whole thing.
Delicious.
And the other thing about aspen that's unique, I don't want to spend the whole time on aspen, but if you scratch the outer white, it's called the phellum, with your thumbnail.
Right.
It's green underneath. They're capable of photosynthesizing through their bark.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay.
Some willows can do that as well.
Okay.
Not cottonwood so much.
So yeah, as we are experiencing this warming world and we are looking at the way that we do plant trees or prune trees, what has changed then to Chris's point of, if I were to say to you, most likely in a backyard, what am I wanting to plant and what time of year do I do that?
Good question. So I think what should be on the back of everybody's mind is water. Mm. We're just running out of water. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make any sense to plant landscapes that are water thirsty. And so I advocate using drought-tolerant species. In addition to being drought-tolerant, heat-tolerant, dust-tolerant, urban-tolerant. And there's a list of things you can use. A lot of the cities around here are starting to use them. Salt Lake, Heber. So there's some really tough trees, especially along streets, because those are some of the toughest sites we have.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the examples of trees that you would
recommend? All right, so down in Heber, and I recommend people start planting this tree up here, is the honey locust, okay? Good, tough tree. You see it growing in parking lots down in Salt Lake. That's how tough it is. Mm. Another one would be Siberian elm. Another one would be hackberry, common hackberry, which is a member of the elm family. You know, if it gets hot enough, the golden rain tree, that's what's used extensively along roads down in Salt Lake City. Pularia.
Okay.
What type of species of birds how does that play a role in the ecosystem in your yard or in nature?
Well, so any tree is good bird habitat, not only for nesting, but they feed on the bugs that feed on the trees, primarily to feed their young, you know, escape from predators. So they eat the buds, eat the leaves.
So you can still have a healthy backyard ecosystem with any of the trees that you just
exactly.
mentioned.
Exactly. But that's a good point. I mean, certain trees are going to attract certain species of birds. Mm-hmm. But my philosophy is just whatever that's a true performer, that's what I plant. Not only will they do better, but less maintenance. You won't have to water them as much. If they have controlled growth, you won't have to prune them as much. That's why I advocate a lot of native plants. That's what I have primarily in my yard.
Is spraying some form of chemicals, natural or otherwise, an option that you consider sometimes if you see a tree that is in its early stages of infestation?
So that would be my last option.
Okay.
And, you know, if it had a borer infestation, obviously that would be your last resort, would be using an insecticide. But there are a lot of plant-feeding insects that can be controlled by biological oils like neem or peppermint or wintergreen oil. Oh. That's primarily what I use.
Peppermint oil. Oh, cool.
So how is that applied?
So it's a foliar application. You mix it with water, spray it on the canopy. It's really effective on aphids. And the way it works is it coats their body. Mm-hmm. You know, and insects breathe by the side of their body through spiracles. So it plugs up the spiracles and they essentially suffocates them.
Okay.
That's so interesting. And that's just a more natural approach that we are not interfering
There's a lot of companies in Park City are doing that.
That's great.
You know, aphids are so easy to control. You know, if you're out there watering your garden, you can just blast them off a tree with a hard blast of water. And they're so fragile, their legs break off and they fall to the ground. And then the ants take care of them.
Ah, well, that was one of my last questions, because I see ants on my crawling up and down my aspen. So is that a bad thing, or can that be beneficial?
So if you have ants crawling on your aphid trees, on your aspen trees, you have aphids.
Okay.
And the way it works is the ants are bodyguards for the aphids. They protect the aphids from predators. And in return, the aphid feeds the ant.
Oh, it does. That's amazing. So I know I have aphids because they
dripping
produce
on your windshield.
Yeah.
It's not all aphids. There's a lot of plant feeders on aspen, like leafhoppers. That's what I have on mine. But the result's the same. They excrete honeydew all over your patio furniture,
right,
your
on
car.
My picnic table.
Windshield of your car.
Yeah.
And then, to make matters worse, there's a mold that'll attack the honeydew called sooty mold and turn it black.
Okay.
Some trees will actually have sooty mold growing on their trunk of their tree.
Oh, okay. Well, we got to wrap
so
up.
So fascinating.
We really appreciate it. Keith Claypere, arborist with Park City Arborist LLC. Thank you, Keith, for joining us this morning.
Thanks
we'll have you
so
back.
Much, Keith. It was so great to have you on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks.